Chapter 7. Fermenting Milk. Fresh milk is largely a 20th century phenomenon, made possible by the advent and spread of refrigeration technology, and the energy to run it. The people who milk cows, goats, and other ruminant mammals have always been able to enjoy fresh milk, but as a practical matter, most other people have had access to milk primarily in fermented forms. Generally, fermentation stabilizes milk, transforming it from a highly perishable substance into much more stable forms. Milk can ferment in many different ways, depending upon methods, cultures and coagulants, environmental conditions, and manipulations. All but the freshest of cheeses are fermented, often for months or even years. The harder the cheese is, which is to say, the more liquid, in the form of whey, has been removed from it, the longer it has the potential to ferment and preserve, generally speaking. Fluid milk and cream are also widely fermented, usually for only a few hours or days, rendering them stable for short-term storage, as well as protected from food poisoning organisms by their acidification. The fermented milk best known in the United States is yogurt, with kefir a distant second. Yogurt is a Turkish name for a style of fermented milk from southeastern Europe and around the Mediterranean. Kefir is also a Turkish name for a very different style of fermented milk from the Caucasus Mountains. Yogurt is typically a firm or semi-solid food, while kefir is a beverage. They also differ in flavor and chemical profiles, microbial cultures, their means of perpetuation, and methods of fermentation. But these are only two styles, and there's quite a bit of variation when it comes to milk. Indeed, around the world, everywhere, humans have long traditions of domesticating animals for their milk. Indigenous styles of fermented milk are found with distinctive names, methods, and cultures. For instance, in the West Pokot district in western Kenya, people ferment a milk known as mala ya kienyeji, or kamabele kambo. When Slow Food designated this ferment as a presidium, seeking to protect the practice, they could only describe it with reference to the number one global fermented milk superstar as ash yogurt in gourds. Yet, it is not really yogurt at all. The milk that starts the ferment is its own particular fusion. It is a mixture of goat's milk with the milk of a local cross, cows bred with animals I have never heard of before, called zebus. Then, the milk is poured into a gourd or calabash. No artificial starters are used, and fermentation and acidification occurs spontaneously after a few days, either from the natural flora of the milk if raw, or from the bacteria found within the vessel. When the milk begins to coagulate, some whey is removed and the vessel is topped up with fresh milk. This process is repeated and the vessel is shaken regularly for around 1 week. An English woman with whom I exchanged a few emails, Roberta Wedge, visited that region of Kenya many years ago and bought a milk fermenting gourd. She recalls, "Every woman carries one, as every man carries a tiny stool and a herding stick. The gourd itself is the vehicle of perpetuation." The fermented milk then has ash mixed into it, which is made by burning a particular local tree known as krumwo. The ash, according to a Slow Food website, has antiseptic properties, adds an aromatic note to the flavor, and colors the yogurt a distinctive pale gray. Traditional forms of fermented milk like this evolved and spread wherever there was domestication of milking animals. A book I came across called Application of Biotechnology to Traditional Fermented Foods broadly defines traditional fermented milk products in order to distinguish them from modern scientific ones. Their production was a crude art made with ill-defined empirical cultures, meaning the inoculum is obtained from a previous production and its microbial identity is unknown. The word in the technical literature for using the old batch to start the new batch is backslopping. The contrasting non-traditional milk ferments, like commercial yogurts and kefirs, based on known scientific principles, were all developed in the 20th century, even though they are all based on traditional styles of fermentation. For mass production, commerce, and marketing, consistency is critical. Traditional fermented milks vary by season, location, maker, and batch. In Zimbabwe, milk has traditionally been fermented by simply leaving it, raw, for a day or two at ambient temperatures in a clay pot. Thus, it is fermented by bacteria present in the milk, the pot, and the air. In the 1980s, a mass-produced fermented milk product was developed and marketed with the name Lacto. In it, milk is standardized, pasteurized at 92 degrees Celsius, 198 degrees Fahrenheit, for 20 minutes, cooled to 22 degrees Celsius, 72 degrees Fahrenheit, and inoculated with 1.2% of an imported starter. But in taste tests, the traditional ferment was significantly more acceptable than lacto. In addition, due to the diversity of the fermenting organisms, investigators found that samples of the traditional fermented milk contained higher levels of B vitamins, thiamine, riboflavin, pyridoxine, and folic acid than did lacto. Despite the superior nutritional profile of the traditional ferment and the population's preference for its flavors, the researchers in this study seek to improve lacto so as to entice rural populations to abandon traditional fermentation and adopt a hygienically safer product. In the name of public health, these traditions, evolved to sustain people with available food resources, are being intentionally eroded and replaced by products that can be mass-produced and generate profit for corporations. In fact, like languages, traditional fermented milk products are disappearing every year, and each silent extinction diminishes the diversity of culture and contributes to global homogenization. We must reject the notion that standardized cultures are superior to indigenous traditions and confront the dogmas regarding hygiene and safety that justify this thinking. The diversity of fermented milk products reflects the glorious diversity of culture itself. Raw milk, microbiology, and politics. Many traditional methods of fermenting milk have relied upon raw milk as its indigenous bacteria. Yogurt typically is made with milk that is heated past the point of pasteurization, then cultured after it cools. But while this technique results in a firmer, thicker yogurt than if you introduce the same culture into raw milk, it is not necessary in order to produce yogurt, and we have no idea how far back the practice of preheating the milk might go, nor how widespread it is or isn't, was or wasn't. But conceptually, the roots of yogurt and all other cultured foods must lie in spontaneous events that were noted, appreciated, and in some way perpetuated. Most likely, these especially pleasing spontaneous events developed out of the lactic acid bacteria-rich environment of raw milk, rather than the microbial blank slate of cooked milk. Even if eventual refinement of the technique yields a process in which the historical culture, or a reasonable facsimile, is introduced into cooked milk, still the culture and the ferment develop out of such spontaneous events. Raw milk is a very rich medium, and in the quantities that people milking animals have produced, accumulated in vessels, and stored, a phenomenon itself with no other precedent in nature, an extraordinary realm of specialized bacteria have evolved. According to geneticists Joel Schroeder and Todd Kleinhammer, humans essentially domesticated these organisms over the last 5,000 years through repeated transfer of LAB cultures for production of fermented dairy products. Though the bacteria have evolved in various ways in these specialized ecological niches that human cultures and their domesticated partners have created, the bacteria grew out of the pool found in the milk itself. The milk of healthy animals is generally wonderful and safe to drink. I first tasted raw milk when I visited the community I ended up living in for 17 years. Like the spring water and garden vegetables, the fresh milk was deeply compelling to me and was part of the allure of the change of life rural community living offered. Fresh raw milk is so much more delicious than the processed mass-market product that I am spoiled forever. After years of enjoying the sweet ambrosia of this milk, I got involved in the daily intimacy of hand-milking the goats, which made the milk much richer and more meaningful. Now that I have moved down the road, I am no longer in the day-to-day milking grind and get my fresh goat's milk from a neighbor with a herd share program. When goats have adequate access to pastures and forests, they are typically healthy and produce healthy and safe milk. The indigenous lactic acid bacteria, LAB, in the milk protect it from other bacteria to which it may be exposed. Growing numbers of people concerned about health and nutrition are turning to raw milk as a nutrient-dense living food. And growing numbers of farmers are returning to small dairy herds on adequate pasture, then direct marketing raw milk as a more viable business plan than maximizing production and selling at a set price to the bulk processors. But healthy raw milk is dependent upon healthy animals, and healthy ruminant animals need land to graze. If the existing U.S. milk supply were to suddenly cease to be pasteurized, it would be a terrible disaster. The milk industry as we know it excels at mass production of cheap milk. In order to accomplish this, land per animal is minimized, and extraordinary means are employed, such as giving cows artificial growth hormones, to boost milk production. Unfortunately, these methods compromise the milk's quality and safety. Animals in the large farms, known as concentrated animal feeding operations, CAFO, do not enjoy the same health as animals allowed to roam and graze, nor does their milk possess the same qualities. If we must drink the milk of these animals, it is safest pasteurized, due to high somatic cell, pus, in the milk from udder stress, and coliform bacteria counts. But let's not extrapolate from that unfortunate reality the simplistic notion that milk can only be safe with pasteurization. That is true only in the limited context of factory farming. Change the context by providing animals with space to roam and graze, and raw milk can certainly be safe, not to mention delicious, nutritious, digestible, and rich in healthful and self-protective lactic acid bacteria. My previous book, The Revolution Will Not Be Microwaved, and many other books and websites contain more information on the intense legal struggles over raw milk distribution, as well as its nutritional aspects. For now, suffice it to say that pasteurized and even ultra-pasteurized milk can be successfully cultured, and you may think of this as a means of salvaging, enriching, and enlivening it. Raw milk, too, can be cultured. But only from raw milk will cultures emerge, and only with raw milk does it make sense to experiment with spontaneous fermentation. Simple clabbering. Clabber is a word that is rapidly fading into obsolescence. It is a surviving traditional English word for curdled fermented milk, deriving from the Gaelic clabar, meaning mud. The metaphor is vivid. When milk clabbers, the word is a verb as well as a noun, it thickens, causing milk fats and solids to come together into something like sludge or mud. This mud is referred to as the curd. The thin liquid it separates from is whey. My father's friend Ray Smith shared with me his Aunt Helen's recipe for clabber, which he fondly remembered from childhood visits to his grandparents' home in North Carolina. Back in the old days, you simply set some milk aside and sooner or later it clabbered by itself, she wrote to him late in her life, after he inquired in a letter. In this day of pasteurized milk, I guess you would need a starter. Here's Aunt Helen's recipe. Put aside in a bowl the amount of milk that you want to clabber. Room temperature is what you want, and put it in a place where it will not be moved or shaken at all during the process. It will probably take about 24 hours to set. You can check it by giving the bowl a slight wiggle, not enough to break the curd, but enough to tell you whether it is set. As the native lactic acid bacteria digest lactose, milk sugar, they create lactic acid. Harold McGee explains, "The increasingly acid conditions cause the normal bundled micelles of casein proteins to fall apart into separate casein molecules, and then rebond to each other. This general rebonding forms a continuous meshwork of protein molecules that traps the liquid and fat globules in small pockets, and turns the fluid milk into a fragile solid. The speed at which this will occur depends upon temperature. At ambient temperatures in summer heat, it could take less than a day. In a cool environment, it could take a couple of days. In the refrigerator, it could take a couple of weeks. Despite our indoctrination that milk spoils easily and should not be consumed unless fresh, an unfortunate lesson of the age of pasteurization and refrigeration, the sour, clabbered version of raw milk is still safe to consume curdled so long as the raw milk itself is safe to drink fresh. This is because the very bacteria that sour it protect it from pathogenic bacteria. Please note that stable and safe do not necessarily equate with delicious. Milks from different animals in different locations will yield very different products when spontaneously fermented. Ambient temperatures during clabbering will strongly influence bacterial as well as enzymatic activity and resulting clabber flavor. Most of my clabbering experiences came during summers milking 5 goats. At certain points, we ran out of space in the refrigerator and were not ready to make cheese. So milk would just sit on the counter in Tennessee summer heat with daily highs around 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees Celsius and clabber within 24 hours. We then skimmed the milk fats from the top. What spontaneously developed from the milk reminded me of sour cream. Maybe you will be so lucky and love what spontaneously develops on milk in your kitchen. But then, maybe you won't. Because of the high degree of variability found in spontaneously fermented milks, people have frequently introduced a small bit of clabber from a batch they liked as a starter to guide the development of the new batch. It is this backslopping step that really distinguishes most of the different styles of fermented milks that people around the world enjoy. If you find yourself with a surplus of raw milk, try clabbering some spontaneously and see how you like what results. If milk is a scarce and precious resource for you, it probably makes more sense to culture it with a reliable starter that you know you will like. Yogurt. Yogurt is the most popular fermented milk in the world. It is distinctive for its thick and creamy, semi-solid consistency and its mildly tart flavor. The bacteria that ferment milk into yogurt are typically, there are exceptions, thermophilic bacteria, active at elevated temperatures. Therefore, to make nice, thick yogurt, you must incubate it, maintaining it in a temperature range between 110 degrees and 115 degrees Fahrenheit, or 43 degrees and 46 degrees Celsius. To make yogurt, you need a starter culture. If you can find or buy a traditional yogurt culture and are good at maintaining a regular rhythm, you may be able to make yogurt from it for the rest of your life. If you want to try making yogurt without delay, you can use commercial yogurt for the starter, always live culture, plain, and without additives. A lengthier discussion of yogurt starters follows this description of how to make it. The first step of the yogurt making process is to remove your starter yogurt from the refrigerator and allow it time to warm to room temperature. Also, fill the jars in which you will make the yogurt, as well as your incubator if you are using an insulated cooler, with warm water, so they can pre-warm and will not later cool your yogurt mixture once it reaches target temperature. As the starter and vessels warm, I heat the milk to at least 180 degrees Fahrenheit, or 82 degrees Celsius. Heat milk slowly and gently, with frequent stirring to avoid scalding. The faster you heat the milk, the more grainy bits of overheated, congealed protein you'll find in your yogurt, warns Rosanna Nafsifer, co-author, with Ken Albala, of the excellent Lost Art of Real Cooking. It is possible to omit this heating step and make raw yogurt, never heating the milk above 115 degrees Fahrenheit or 46 degrees Celsius. But raw yogurt will never be as thick as yogurt from milk that has been heat-treated. What this heating accomplishes, aside from killing native bacteria that could compete with the introduced cultures, is to alter the structure of the milk protein, casein, a key to thick, firm yogurt. Holding the milk at this high temperature with constant stirring will result in evaporation and concentration of milk, further contributing to a thicker end product. It is in simulation of this traditional evaporation step that many yogurt manufacturers and people making it at home add powdered milk or other thickening additives. After heating the milk, you must allow it to cool before adding the starter culture. You may simply leave the pot of heated milk to slowly cool, monitoring it periodically so you can add cultures as soon as the temperature drops to 115 degrees Fahrenheit or 46 degrees Celsius. Or you can actively cool it by filling a sink, tub, pot, or bowl with cold water and setting the pot of heated milk in the cold water. Stir the milk in the pot as well as the water around it for rapid cooling. Don't wait for the temperature to reach target before removing the pot of milk from the cold water, or it will cool further. Remove it from the cooling bath as the temperature approaches 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 49 degrees Celsius. Once the temperature reaches 115 degrees Fahrenheit or 46 degrees Celsius, remove a cup of the milk into a cup or bowl and stir in starter. I use 1 tablespoon of starter per quart/liter. Many recipes suggest using more starter, and in my early yogurt making experiences I did, but based on the recommendation of The Joy of Cooking, I tried a less is more approach and found that it made thicker yogurt. A tablespoon is just under 5% of a quart or liter. A dairy production reference book I consulted recommended using yogurt starter at a proportion of 2 to 5%, so you could use even less. Thoroughly mix the starter with the cup of heated milk. Once it is fully dissolved, mix it back into the full pot of heated milk. Then transfer cultured milk to preheated jars, seal, and place in the incubation chamber, leaving it to ferment undisturbed. Incubate it at 115 degrees Fahrenheit or 46 degrees Celsius, yogurt will coagulate within about 3 hours, but if left too long, it can easily curdle. I prefer to ferment it a bit more slowly at a slightly lower temperature, 4 to 8 hours at a more forgiving 110 degrees Fahrenheit or 43 degrees Celsius. Even longer fermentations can yield more tangy flavor and fuller digestion of lactose. I have heard of people fermenting yogurt for as long as 24 hours. At lower temperatures, coagulation will take longer, and the end result will probably not be quite as thick. If you should open your incubator and find your yogurt still runny, add hot water bottles to heat it up, and leave it for a few more hours at warmer temperatures. If for some reason your yogurt fails to coagulate at all, which can happen, you do not need to discard the milk. You can easily turn it into a simple acid-curdled cheese. Kemakli yogurt. Aylin Unetan, Istanbul, Turkey. The basic method of making yogurt is pretty much the same all over, but there are a few tricks that make the whole difference. Boiling down the milk to a condensed state is one way to achieve thicker yogurt. Constant stirring and airing with a spoon speeds the process and prevents burning the bottom of the pot. When transferring the milk to the setting vessels, pouring from a height forms a foamy froth, which will eventually turn into a thick, clotted yogurt cream, a delicacy in itself. The skin or cream that forms on the surface of yogurt is called kaimak. The creamy crust is usually delicately removed from the surface of yogurt and eaten with a drizzle of honey at breakfast. Yogurt is certainly wonderful as it is, plain. In the United States, people typically sweeten it with jam, fruit, or sugar, but traditionally it has more often been used with savory flavors. With simple spicing, yogurt becomes a sauce or condiment, like Greek tzatziki or Indian raita. Hung over a bowl in fine cheesecloth or tea towel, whey drips out and it becomes labneh, yogurt cheese, popular in the Middle East. Mixed with bulgur and further fermented, it becomes a soup flavoring and thickener known as kishk. My friend Pardis once made me a Persian feast, accompanied by dhu, a yogurt-based savory soda, which I have come to love as a thirst-quenching refreshment in hot weather. In Turkey, where yogurt is incorporated into the cuisine in an extraordinary variety of ways, one way of preserving yogurt is to dry it into a hard and very stable block, known as kurut, which is then grated, crushed, or pounded into a powder. In the cultures that have evolved using yogurt for thousands of years, it is integrated into all aspects of the cuisine. Yogurt has become a ubiquitous food in Western supermarkets and kitchens, but it was not always so. 100 years ago, yogurt was known primarily in southeastern Europe, Turkey, and the Middle East. It was a regional food known beyond that primarily among immigrant communities, but otherwise obscure. Pioneer microbiologist Ilya Metchnikoff, who studied longevity in Bulgaria and attributed it to yogurt, popularized the idea that yogurt and other fermented milks could improve health and extend life, giving scientific credibility to a notion that was already part of the received culture in many traditions. Metchnikoff's research spurred popular interest in yogurt as a medicinal product. Dr. Isaac Carrasco started a state-of-the-art yogurt factory in Barcelona, Spain in 1919, using bacteria isolated and cultured by Metchnikoff's Pasteur Institute in Paris. Carrasco, a Sephardic Jew, had recently moved his family to Barcelona from Thessaloniki, now part of Greece, where yogurt was an important food. He called his business Danun, a Catalan nickname for his son Daniel. Daniel learned the family business and set off for Paris in 1929 to establish Danun there. During World War II, he left Europe for the United States and took Danun with him, establishing a yogurt factory in the Bronx in 1942. According to the website of the company, he changed the name Danun to Danon to make the brand sound more American. Daniel Carrasco died in 2009 at the age of 103. "My dream was to make Danun a worldwide brand," he said shortly before his death, at a celebration of the 90th anniversary of the company's founding. He succeeded in making yogurt into a global staple. But the yogurt that he made was different from traditional yogurt in at least one key respect. It was made using a blend of bacteria that had been isolated from Bulgarian yogurt at the Pasteur Institute, including the ones we now know as Lactobacillus delbrueckii, subspecies Bulgaricus, and Streptococcus salivarius, subspecies Thermophilus. This was different from how yogurt had previously been cultured, which was simply to use yogurt from the last batch. All yogurt was made from a previous batch of yogurt in long lineage. In varied locations, the yogurt communities diverged. Yogurt is a Turkish word, yet yogurt-like ferments have been historically associated with not only Turkey, but also Southeastern Europe and the Middle East. The cultures and techniques probably spread via nomadic herding peoples, and they evolve distinctively in different locations, as does any food that gets spread over a vast territory, especially a fermented one. And besides being regionally varied, traditional yogurt cultures also consisted of more complex communities, involving organisms beyond the two bacteria that the Pasteur Institute identified as the critical ones, and that legally define yogurt in our time. The traditional yogurt cultures were evolved communities with a certain amount of inherent stability to them. Dhu, Persian yogurt soda. To make dhu, stir plain yogurt to break its structure until it is smooth, then stir in a little fresh or dried mint, salt, and fresh ground black pepper to taste. Once they are mixed into the yogurt, add either plain or carbonated water, at least as much as the yogurt you used, usually more, and mix to reach the desired consistency. Enjoy. You can also carbonate dhu the traditional way, mixing ingredients as directed above and leaving sealed in an airtight bottle for a day or two to continue fermenting so pressure will build. Bulgarian-Japanese yogurt culture. Aaron Boros, Boston, Massachusetts. I picked up a yogurt culture on a visit to Japan in 2001 and have been harvesting it ever since. I'm sure if the customs officer at JFK had seen it, I wouldn't have it today. I have a super simple technique. I simply skim off any foul-looking stuff at the top, eat as much as I want, and leave about 1/2 inch in the bottom of the container. Then I fill it with whole milk and leave it on the counter for 24 hours, covered with cheesecloth. Every 3 or 4 times I make it, I move the whole thing to a clean container. No cooking, no stirring, no nothing. Super easy, and it's lasted me 9 years so far. It makes a somewhat runny yogurt, although sometimes it sets really nicely. I haven't spent much time thinking about what makes it set better, although I suspect it's timing when to put it in the fridge just right, and something about room temperature, too. I heard a rumor this is the famed Bulgarian-Japanese yogurt culture that will allow me to live forever, but that provenance is unverified. A few times I've neglected it for 3 or 4 weeks, and it gets a lot of yellow-slash-brown-slash-orange spoiled rind on the top, but if I can dig down and find a little bit of white yogurt underneath, I have always been able to use that to make successively larger batches to recover the whole thing. Only in preparing to write this book did I finally get hold of a traditional yogurt culture. Actually, I purchased online and have been maintaining not one culture, but two, which I have come to know as B and G, for Bulgarian and Greek. The fact that I have made repeated batches for more than a year already sets these cultures apart from the store-bought yogurts I have used as starters until now. In my experience, the cultures in commercial yogurt never maintain their effectiveness as starters beyond a few generations. The problem with cultures derived from isolated laboratory strains, from a practical standpoint, is that they are inherently unstable. They cannot effectively perpetuate themselves. Traditional yogurts can and do perpetuate themselves. 14 months after their arrival in my kitchen, B and G are making yogurt every bit as thick and delicious as the first batch. There is a century-old Knish maker in New York City, Yona Schimmels, that serves yogurt they claim to still make from the original starter its founder migrated with to New York. After Eva Bakkeslett of Norway read about Yona Schimmels' yogurt in wild fermentation, she bought some while visiting New York and brought a sample of it home with her. She has successfully perpetuated it for several years now, shared it widely, and established a blog to chart the spread of this and other milk cultures. Yogurt cultures need not be so fragile and lacking in resilience that starters require refreshing every second or third batch. For yogurt traditions to have been continuous, they had to be self-perpetuating beyond a few generations. I've asked a number of microbiologists and other experts how to explain why the traditional cultures remain so much more stable than the laboratory-derived cultures. Betty Steckmeyer, co-founder of Gem Cultures, who commercially propagated numerous cultures for decades, views the microbial diversity of traditional yogurt cultures as the source of their greater stability and endurance. An ecosystem in a bowl with less diversity can be more easily knocked off balance than one with a whole host of players. Microbiologist Jessica Lee concurs, making reference to bacteriophages, viruses that attack bacteria. With a single strain of bacteria, a phage outbreak can quickly kill the entire bacterial population and end the fermentation process, she says. Yogurts made with two isolated strains are no more resilient. Local bacteriophages eventually evolve to be able to infect the few strains that make up that starter and slowly kill them off. The difference with a traditional starter is that it is composed of more varied bacteria, so that when one strain falls prey to phages, there will be others to take over and maintain fermentation. This is an elegant story to argue the practical value of biodiversity and traditional methods of fermentation. The New England Cheesemaking Supply Company sells several yogurt strains, some marketed as reculturable, some not. When I asked why, I received an email explaining that the reculturable cultures they sell are undefined, while those that are defined are not typically regarded as reculturable. As for why, when I ask the culture producer experts, they are pretty vague on this. Sources of heirloom yogurt cultures. Although you can make yogurt from any live culture yogurt, only traditional heirloom cultures will be able to perpetuate themselves over time. Commercial sources of heirloom yogurt cultures are listed in resources. If you are willing to do some searching, you may be able to find someone locally who has maintained a yogurt culture for years near where you live. Try posting notices on local computer bulletin boards or contacting food advocacy groups and local chapters of groups like Slow Food and the Weston A. Price Foundation. Try contacting local food writers, too. A brief write-up on your search in the local paper could easily catch the eyes of the right person. I have no doubt that there are many practical benefits, especially in commercial production, to using defined strains rather than undefined or empirical cultures. The combination of L. bulgaricus and S. thermophilus does indeed render a lovely ferment with a pleasing texture and flavor. The laboratory-derived starters yield consistently good results, so long as you start with pure cultures in each batch. But I can't help but wonder what has been lost of the diverse old-world milk cultures. It reminds me of the tragedy with vegetable seeds, where a handful of improved varieties led to widespread abandonment of localized varieties. The improved varieties outperformed under ideal conditions, but were not so well adapted to actual climatic and environmental conditions, thus demanding irrigation and pesticides. In addition, hybrid seeds, specific crosses that are not self-regenerating, breed dependence by requiring the expertise of breeders, where previously the seeds had been self-perpetuating. Similarly with yogurt, where once it was always derived from the last batch of yogurt, like a seed, a living legacy from ancestors and their coevolutionary partners, without that living legacy, we have become dependent on technology that is beyond the scope of the generalist. Revive, reclaim, and reinvent living fermentation legacies. Find those surviving yogurt cultures, or more obscure ones. We cannot allow cultures that function as vibrant, self-sustaining communities to be replaced by commodified, pure cultures isolated and bred in laboratories, no matter what perceived improvements they may offer. Kefir. Kefir is another popular culture for fermenting milk. It produces a beverage, thicker than milk, that can be made from ever so mildly tart to super sour, and best of all, if properly prepared, it is bubbly. The community of organisms that ferment milk into kefir includes yeasts, which produce alcohol at levels ranging from a few negligible tenths of a percentage to as high as 3%, depending upon length of fermentation and other factors. Because of its alcohol content and its effervescence, kefir is sometimes called the champagne of milks. Kefir is notable among milk cultures in that rather than using a bit of fermented milk to start the next batch, it relies upon a SCOBY, a rubbery mass of bacterial and fungal cells that has evolved an elaborate symbiotic arrangement, sharing nutrients, coordinating reproduction, and co-creating a shared form, which is not microscopic. I've seen extremely varied kefir forms. All of them are whitish and plump, with curvaceous, undulating surfaces, something like a cross between cauliflower florets and little brains. Most of the kefir grains I have encountered grow into clumps measuring up to a few inches in any direction. Some have been smaller, so that as they grow, there are more and more small clumps, but the clumps do not grow larger. On a few occasions, I have seen extraordinarily large kefir clumps. The largest kefir I have ever seen was a clump that spread out like a sheet, more than a foot wide, with familiar kefir clumps connected by flatter sections. Again, we see that biological creations always exhibit diverging branches of the family tree. The biology of kefir is quite fascinating. It is a symbiotic entity that self-reproduces. Combining each of the individual bacterial and fungal members will not result in a new kefir grain. All kefir grains evolved from a spontaneous symbiosis, or a number of them, that has perpetuated itself. Despite intensive research and many attempts to produce kefir grains from the pure or mixed cultures that are normally present in the grains, no successful results have been reported to date, reports the Journal of Dairy Science. Biologist Lynn Margulis asserts, kefir can no more be made by the right mix of chemicals or microbes than can oak trees or elephants. Margulis, whose work in the field of symbiogenesis I referred to in Chapter 1, has written about kefir as a vivid illustration of fundamental biological concepts, such as life, death, sex, and evolution. She points out that kefir grains do not possess programmed death, as animals, plants, and certain other organisms do, and therefore may theoretically live forever, given adequate nutrition and tolerable environmental conditions. Margulis explains that kefir grains involve a community of 30 different types of microbes, including common food fermentation favorites, such as lactobacilli, leuconostic, acetobacter, and saccharomyces, as well as others more obscure. In fact, according to Margulis, fewer than half the microbes involved are known or named. Nonetheless, these specific yeasts and bacteria must reproduce together by coordinated cell division that does not involve fertilization or any other aspect of sex to maintain the integrity of the unusual microbial individual that is the kefir curd, she writes. The component organisms are inextricably connected by chemical compounds, glycoproteins, and carbohydrates of their own making. Kefir microbes are entirely integrated into the new being, just as the former symbiotic bacteria that become components of nucleated cells are integrated. Kefir is a sparkling demonstration that the integration processes by which our cells evolved from bacteria still occur. Despite their potential for immortality, forget to feed them too long and kefir grains will die and decompose. I've had mine simply dissolve, from neglect for weeks at a time, into the acidic kefir they had created. Margulis observes, dead kefir curds teem with a kind of life that is something other than kefir, a smelly mush of irrelevant fungi and bacteria thriving and metabolizing, but no longer in integrated fashion, on corpses of what once were live individuals. The moral of the story? Kefir grains require regular care and feeding. Except for the challenge of getting into a rhythm, making kefir is extremely easy. No heating or temperature regulation is required, though kefir will ferment faster if you gently heat milk from refrigerator temperature to ambient room temperature. Simply add kefir grains to milk in a jar. Use about a heaping tablespoon of grains for 1 quart/liter of milk. Most of the literature concurs that kefir is best cultured at a ratio around 5% grains. Do not fill the jar all the way, as carbon dioxide production can result in an increase in volume. You can either seal the jar, in which case pressure will build, or loosely cover it. Leave kefir to ferment at ambient temperatures, out of direct sunlight, and shake or stir periodically. Because microbial activity is concentrated on the surfaces of the grains, the agitation is important to move the grains around, circulate the milk, and thus spread microbial activity. Kefir is ready when you can see that it has thickened, around 24 hours, or longer if you live in a cool environment, or prefer it sour. Shake the jar of kefir one last time before removing the grains. You can either fish the grains out with a spoon, especially if they're big, or strain through a strainer. To carbonate, transfer the strained kefir to a sealable vessel, allowing room for expansion, and leave to ferment sealed another few hours or a few days in the refrigerator. When you open the sealed jar of kefir, it will froth and rise. It's that easy. I always use whole milk, raw when available, though my friend Nina reports that she prefers making kefir from non-fat milk. I have had fine results with raw milk, pasteurized, and even ultra-pasteurized, goat's milk and cow's milk, both homogenized and not. Some of the literature encourages not allowing kefir grains to come into contact with metal. I would certainly concur insofar as prolonged contact with metal can result in corrosion, as with any acidic ferment. But some kefir promoters are emphatic that even brief contact with metal, such as mesh strainers, can destroy kefir grains. I have never found this to be true. Nor has the man I call the Internet King of Kefir, Dominic Anfiteatro of Australia, who in his typical comprehensive way conducted a small experiment. We've used stainless steel strainers to strain kefir for months on end without any evidence to suggest that the grains or the microflora are impaired in any way, he writes on his website. When you strain kefir from the kefir grains, transfer to a clean jar, pour fresh milk over the grains, and continue the rhythm. The rhythm is the hard part. Ideally, each time you strain a batch of mature kefir from the grains, you start another batch. Maintaining kefir grains, or any other SCOBY, ultimately is like having a pet. They require not constant but ongoing attention. If they are not adequately nourished, they will die. With all the traveling I do, I have lost my kefir grains on more than one occasion. At present, I am making and drinking about 2 cups of kefir every other day. Every other morning, I strain the kefir and pour fresh milk over the grains. The grains double every week or 10 days. You can store extras to share later without having to keep feeding them by drying them. Rinse them, drain on absorbent paper, and dry in the sun and/or a dehydrator at low temperature. You can slow kefir grains down in the refrigerator, but you still need to feed them after about a week. You can suspend them for a long while also by freezing them, but kefir grains work best and stay healthiest with frequent engagement and regular feeding. One characteristic of healthy kefir grains is that they grow and reproduce rapidly. As the proportion of grains to milk increases, your kefir will ferment faster and faster. It's best to remove excess grains to maintain a grain-milk ratio of no more than about 10%. Thus, everyone who keeps kefir grains and makes kefir regularly ends up with more grains than they know what to do with. So if you can find those people, they will generally be thrilled to share grains with you. One interesting aspect of kefir is that most of the products prepared commercially in the United States and much of the rest of the world are not made using traditional kefir grains. Instead, they are made using starter cultures consisting of some of the known organisms that are part of the traditional kefir symbiosis, but not all of them, and without the complexity and resulting unity of kefir's evolved life form. A few reasons for this are cited in the literature. One is the slow increase in the size of the kefir grains, resulting in limitations on expanding production. Another is the difficulty of producing a consistent product due to the complex microbiology of kefir grains. In addition, the alcohol present in kefir, which definitely has the potential to increase above the 0.5% maximum level for non-alcoholic beverages, can create regulatory and legal challenges, as we have seen with kombucha. And because the alcohol fermentation typically becomes dominant after the lactic acid fermentation, it tends to occur at the distribution stage of the products, thereby resulting not only in substantial changes in flavor and taste due to the formation of ethanol and carbon dioxide gas, but also in bulging of containers and leakage of the contents. For these reasons, much research has gone into the development of alternative starter cultures for kefir. Several processes have been developed to produce a kefir-like beverage in which no grains are used, reports the Journal of Dairy Science. That seems like the appropriate language to use, kefir-like beverage. Kefir is a specific product created by a specific culture with a distinctive form. It hardly seems legitimate to call a cultured milk product kefir if it is fermented by anything other than the grains that have always defined kefir. The laboratory-produced starter cultures can produce beverages that may be very delicious and beneficial to health, but they are not kefir. The quality of these kefir products is significantly different from that of kefir fermented with grains, concludes the Journal of Dairy Science. It is evident that the final product, as produced from kefir grains, will have a larger number and variety of microorganisms than kefir produced from a mixture of a small number of pure cultures, states the Food Science and Technology Bulletin. Powdered starters approximating kefir are not limited to large-scale manufacturing operations. Several powdered kefir starters are available for small-scale home production. I have never tried the powdered starters, but especially for people who do not want the commitment of maintaining live kefir grains and prefer to make kefir intermittently rather than in a regular rhythm, powdered starters could make sense, even if what they produce is not actually kefir.